And even when we are able to reach out, those who might usually offer support are grieving their own losses. Psychologist Chris Cheers says, people's capacity to support each other, I think it's starting to diminish. When Australia first went into lockdown in March of 2020, Prime Minister Scott Morrison warned the pandemic could last 6 months. He was wrong, of course. The pandemic is still going, and the mental and physical effects of living under it have accumulated. Psychologist Chris Cheers added, in terms of lockdown's impact on mental health and on the brain, this doesn't get easier, this gets harder. He added, the impacts of stress and the impacts of all the loss that lockdowns bring are cumulative. That cumulative stress moves people away from the hope. Chris Cheers added, during Melbourne's 112-day lockdown last year, there was a sense of collective purpose that provided some meaning behind the restrictions. We were locking down to save elderly people, to save our community. We were locking down one last time. Data from the Medicare benefits schedule shows a surge in demand for services during Melbourne's second wave of lockdown last year, which was not matched in other states. Chris Cheers says this year, with the Delta variant of the coronavirus racing against the vaccine rollout and winning, that sense of purpose has fractured to be replaced by a sense of frustration and anger. He says, when that doesn't shift, it then moves to that hopelessness or apathy, which I'm seeing more and more in many clients now. Wait list has never been longer. The decision to double the number of Medicare subsidized psychology appointments from 5 to 10 was welcome news for clients, but the number of psychologists has not changed. Even with a Medicare rebate, those booking a private psychologist have to be able to pay the gap. Doubling the number of sessions does not make it more accessible. The pivot to telehealth has also required a rapid reskilling. Chris Cheers has been conducting one-on-one therapy via Zoom in his spare room in Melbourne for the past 18 months, replacing years of practice in reading body language with a new skill of making eye contact through a webcam. He says, if you make eye contact with someone on video, it doesn't feel like eye contact because you're looking at them on the screen and not on the camera. He added, to make eye contact, I have to make up with the camera. So I feel like I'm doing therapy with a green light at the moment. And psychologists are also living in a pandemic, living through the same lockdowns and restrictions as their clients. Chris Cheers says it gives them a pathway to understanding and empathy, but it has also wrung them dry. He says, I think a lot of psychologists would join me in saying that right now we're exhausted, but we're all incredibly needed. He added, our wait lists are long, our clients are in need, and that's a very challenging place to be, to know that there is so much support that's needed that you can offer at the same time when your capacity to support is depleted. According to a new World Health Organization survey, the COVID-19 pandemic has disrupted or halted critical mental health services in 93% of countries worldwide, while the demand for mental health is increasing. The survey of 130 countries provides the first global data showing the devastating impact of COVID-19 on access to mental health services and underscores the urgent need for increased funding. The survey was published ahead of World Health Organization's big event for mental health, a global online advocacy event on 10th of October this year that will bring together world leaders, celebrities and advocates to call for increased mental health investments in the wake of COVID-19. The World Health Organization, WHO, has previously highlighted the chronic underfunding of mental health. Prior to the pandemic, countries were spending less than 2% of their national health budgets on mental health and struggling to meet their population's needs. And the pandemic is increasing demand for mental health services. Bereavement, isolation, loss of income, and fear are all triggering mental health conditions or exacerbating existing ones. Many people may be facing increased levels of alcohol and drug use, insomnia, and anxiety. Meanwhile, COVID-19 itself can lead to neurological and mental complications such as delirium, agitation, and stroke. People with pre-existing mental, neurological, and/or substance abuse disorders are also more vulnerable to SARS-CoV-2 infection. They may stand a high risk of severe outcomes and even death. Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, Director General of the World Health Organization, said, "Good mental health is absolutely fundamental to overall health and well-being," adding, "COVID-19 has interrupted essential mental health services around the world, just when they're needed most. World leaders must move fast and decisively to invest more in life-saving mental health programs during the pandemic and beyond." The survey evaluates how the provision of mental, neurological, and substance abuse services has changed due to COVID-19, the types of services that have been disrupted, and how countries are adapting to overcome these challenges. Countries reported widespread disruption of many kinds of critical mental health services. Over 60% reported disruptions to mental health services for vulnerable people, including children and adolescents, 72%, older adults, 70%, and women requiring antenatal and postnatal services, 61%. 67% saw disruptions to counseling and psychotherapy, 65% to critical harm reduction services, and 45% to opioid agonist maintenance treatment for opioid dependence. More than a third, or 35%, reported disruptions to emergency interventions, including those for people experiencing prolonged seizures, severe substance use withdrawal syndromes, and delirium, often a sign of serious underlying medical condition. 30% reported disruptions to access for medications for mental, neurological, and substance use disorders. Around three-quarters reported at least partial disruptions to school and workplace mental health services, that is 78% and 75% respectively.
The subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address the most significant issues in the subcontinent that affect the governments, communities, organizations, and the region as a whole. And as usual, we will try to explore and explain its geopolitics, untangle the arguments from different perspectives, and make the alternative voices heard.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to take a look at the need for an inclusive and representative government in Afghanistan that will pave the way for peace, stability, and national reconciliation. And we shall discuss the growing international criticism of Taliban's predominantly Pashtun interim government dominated by the group's old guard.
Following its lightning-fast takeover of Afghanistan in mid-August, a comeback of sorts, Taliban pledged to form an inclusive, broad-based government. However, the caretaker setup announced by the group is predominantly Pashtun, filled with mostly old guard stalwarts. The lack of inclusiveness and diversity in Taliban's interim government has drawn sharp criticism from the international community, which believes the group has reneged on its commitments. While non-Pashtun stakeholders have been completely sidelined in the Taliban government, women also have zero representation.
Taliban's interim cabinet, announced on September 7th, is stacked with the group's hardline loyalists in a throwback to the 1990s rule. More importantly, it's dominated by Pashtuns, the largest ethnic group in Afghanistan. The government is headed by Muhammad Hassan Akhund, the longtime head of Taliban's leadership council and a close associate of the group's late founder Mullah Omar. His lieutenants include Abdul Ghani Baradar, the former lead negotiator, and Abdul Salam Hanafi, the only non-Pashtun member in the group's top leadership. The interim setup, which saw several new additions on September 22nd, is believed to be lacking the representative character, as it ignores the country's ethnic, tribal, and religious diversity. Non-Pashtuns have been completely sidelined in the new governing structure, barring a handful of pro-Taliban Tajiks and Uzbeks. Women have also been cold-shouldered in the all-male government, which has sparked a vicious backlash. While Afghan women, not willing to squander the gains of several years, have taken to the streets in Kabul in recent weeks to protest their non-inclusion, the members of various ethnic and tribal groups are also demanding their legitimate political representation. Their calls have been backed by the international community, including the United Nations, which has termed an inclusive Afghan government with representatives from all ethnic, religious, and political groups as critical.
Such a move would be critical and required moving forward if the Taliban wants to operate as a legitimate government of Afghanistan for a long time. These past 20 years have been transformative for the Taliban. They've, you know, rebranded from a guerrilla fighting group into a legitimate state actor once again, and it seemingly they have measures in place to try to sustain the longevity of their statehood this time, instead of, you know, just being in power for 5 years. So in order for that to happen, they must account for the ethnic and religious minorities of the country and Afghan women, and these groups are fundamental components of the social fabric, political fabric, economic fabric of the country. So if they want to revitalize the economy, get it up and running again, if they want people to come to work, especially with regards to public service, then they need to adjust themselves accordingly. I mean, it's very difficult to say how the group will react or how the group will act, especially for accounting for the different ideological difference, the various ideological difference within the group in terms of interpretation not only of their theocratic forms of government, but also how day-to-day governance should be implemented. It's much too early to tell how that factionality in the group is going to play out. And, you know, the transitionary government has just been, cabinet has just been announced. So we'll really have to wait and see in the post-2022 context to see when the Constitution Committee is doing its work, what kind of are the long-term plans of the group with regards to ethnic religious minorities in particular and Afghan women, because we know that those particular groups refuse to take things lying down. They have been very active, very vocal with regards to the sustainment of their rights, and that's not going to go away. And the Taliban essentially can't make that go away. This isn't the same framework that they had governed in beforehand.
Afghanistan's ethnic mosaic has been at the center of the country's turbulent politics for more than a century. Taliban's first stint in the late 1990s was marked by brutal suppression of ethnic minorities, in particular the Hazara community. The successive US-backed regimes in Kabul since 2001 only exacerbated the problem. Having staged a comeback after 20 years of war against foreign occupiers, Taliban officials insist that they have changed. But have they really changed? Well, that remains a big question.
Taliban spokesman Zabihullah Mujahid, in his first news conference on August 17th, 2 days after the group's dramatic takeover of Kabul, struck a conciliatory tone. He promised peace and good governance at home, with participation of different political and ethnic groups. He made all the right noises, which showed the militant group's desire to join the international mainstream and be seen as a credible political movement. Statements by Mujahid and other Taliban officials since August 17th raised hopes that the second coming of the group known for its brutal persecution of ethnic minorities in 1990s will be refreshingly different. Many believe that the experience of past 20 years has led to the militant group's ideological and political evolution. However, words and deeds haven't been in sync so far. One of the factors responsible for Ashraf Ghani's government's staggering fall from grace was his inability to bring together different ethnic groups. During his 7 eventful years in power, he earned dubious distinction for patronizing the majority Pashtun community while sidelining minorities. That has made the job even more difficult for the Taliban. An inclusive, participative, and broad-based government is expected to help Taliban gain acceptance at home and recognition abroad, as well as establish itself as an alternative to US-backed regimes that institutionalized ethnic discrimination in Afghanistan over the years. So the choice is clear: follow the same beaten path or chart a new course.
No country has so far recognized the Taliban government, including Pakistan and Saudi Arabia, the only two countries that recognized the group in the late 1990s. The international community has tied the group's recognition and legitimacy to accommodation of different political and ethnic stakeholders in the government. Heeding the growing cause is particularly important at a time when the war-ravaged country, abandoned by the US-led NATO alliance after a disastrous military adventure, is staring at a major humanitarian crisis due to frozen assets and severe economic downturn.
UN Security Council, in a resolution passed on September 17th, extended the World Body's assistance mission in Afghanistan for 6 months. It also emphasized the need to establish an inclusive government with representatives from all ethnic, religious, and political groups of Afghan society. Shanghai Cooperation Organization, a powerful Eurasian alliance, in its summit last month, also sought representation for all ethnic, religious, and political groups in the new political dispensation in Kabul. European Union criticized the interim government of Taliban as neither inclusive nor representative of the country's ethnic and religious diversity. China and Russia, who have moved to assert themselves as key players in Afghanistan, also urged the Taliban government to put in place a broad-based and inclusive political framework. Iran and Pakistan, the two closest neighbors of Afghanistan, expressed concern over lack of inclusivity in Taliban's caretaker government while adopting wait-and-watch approach. Pakistan's Premier Imran Khan even offered a dialogue with the group for the formation of an inclusive government. Taliban, however, shot back saying that countries have no right to make demands of an inclusive government. While the group has so far appeared dismissive of the growing clamor, it realizes that playing the ball with other countries is the only way to avoid political isolation and a worst humanitarian catastrophe.
Afghanistan is a multi-ethnic country of 40 million people, with no single ethnic group being a decisive majority. The fissures between the different ethnic and tribal groups have often played out in the cutthroat field of politics, with Pashtuns almost always prevailing over the Tajiks, Hazaras, and the Uzbeks due to numerical strength. Many Pashtun politicians have over the years claimed the right to rule in Afghanistan, with other groups playing the second fiddle role. The Taliban seem to be following the same blueprint, but as they say, times have changed.
Owing to decades of foreign-imposed war in Afghanistan, no accurate or scientific census exists on its population, including the size of each ethnic group. Pashtun community, based in the south and east of the country, has an edge over other ethnic groups in terms of numbers, but it is not big enough to form a majority according to multiple studies. There are broadly 14 ethnic groups in Afghanistan, including Pashtun, Tajik, Hazara, Uzbek, Turkmen, Baluch, Pachai, Nuristani, Aymak, Arab, Kyrgyz, Kizilbash, Gujur, Brahui. The first four groups are larger in size, but Pashtuns remain the largest group. According to rough estimates, they comprise around 40-45% of overall population, followed by Tajiks and Hazaras with around 15-20% each. With no group having a clear majority, presidential candidates have always lobbied with other ethnic groups to form the government. Hamid Karzai did it in 2004, and Ashraf Ghani did it in 2014. But the real representative character still eluded the two US-backed governments. The presidential elections in 2014 and 2019 were both marred by a dispute between Ghani and his Tajik challenger, Dr. Abdullah Abdullah, which illustrated deep ethnic fault lines in the Hindu Kush country. In recent weeks, Panjshiri resistance to the Taliban again showed how politics in Afghanistan unfolds on a complex ethnic landscape.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Iraj Rafiq from Khalq Collective, the collective of Afghan and Iranian revolutionary anti-imperialists. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Rafiq. Now, as we mentioned on the program, Taliban's interim government is stacked with hardline figures from its old guard, certainly not an inclusive, broad-based governing structure. Now, do you think it will affect its legitimacy and international recognition?
Yes, I think having a representative government isn't a bad thing, but you know, the state in society isn't an objective entity. It's controlled by a certain group or a certain class of people who in turn use the state to facilitate their own interests. So in Afghanistan's situation, for example, you can potentially have a representative government, but if that government still facilitates the interests of the most hardline faction of the Taliban, then, you know, what use has that been? So, you know, the US knew who they were making peace deals with when they invited the Taliban delegation to Doha without the presence of the internationally recognized Afghan government at the time. And, you know, when they were withdrawing from the country as well, US and NATO, you know, the Taliban took the country within days, you know, 11 to 12 days. And, you know, the Afghanistan government's forces kept being pulled out of all the locations, and in the end there was hardly any fighting, and you know, which is good, because you know, fighting leads to violence, and of course violence leads to the bloodshed of innocent people, which didn't take place. But at the same time, you know, Taliban took control of the country without any resistance, so this was the intended result that US and NATO wanted. So why all of a sudden is there a change of tune? Why all of a sudden is there, you know, all these stipulations that say, no, Taliban needs to have a representative government, they need to do better for, you know, X, Y, and Z. And all the while, the US and NATO knew exactly who the Taliban were, and they still made the peace deals with them.
Mr. Rafiq, now that the Taliban is back, Taliban spokesman Zabihullah Mujahid has termed it a transitionary setup. But can the group afford dilly-dallying at a time when the country is staring at political isolation and economic meltdown?
Yeah, I do think, you know, the Taliban have taken a while to get together a constitution. And in the end, of course, they've gone for the, you know, King Zia Shah era constitution, which isn't too dissimilar from how the installed Hamid Karzai government of the post 2001 US and NATO invasion of Afghanistan worked. And you know, because the Taliban aren't a unified force, they're not a monolithic force, they're certainly two different factions. You have the Doha Committee faction and you have the Haqqani faction. So the Doha Committee are the relatively more progressive side of the Taliban, and you have the more hardline Haqqani faction. So when they do implement their own constitution, as has been said, you know, that they will do so in 2022, it will be interesting what kind of laws they have, and it would be even more interesting to see how those laws are implemented in the country. For the time being, you know, in terms of the financial assets and the economy and such, you know, the freezing of the funds and the sanctions that have been placed on the country, you know, this has been taking place by the US and at the behest of the US and other allied Western states. And this only affects the Afghan people. You know, Taliban not having access to these funds isn't going to affect the Taliban so much as it's going to affect the people. You can see this from, you know, the queues every single day outside of banks, and, you know, people waiting to get food for, you know, from places, you know, outside of places like mosques and other charity centers. And, you know, well over 50% of the country is currently living in poverty conditions. And as has been stated by the UN, you know, there's a serious risk of famine for the Afghan people. So, you know, the situation with the sanctions and the freezing of assets must be turned around as soon as possible.
Mr. Rafiq, the international community, including regional countries, is faced with two choices at the moment vis-a-vis Afghanistan: engagement or abandonment. Now, how are the two choices going to affect the country and its people?
We've already seen the effects of what a policy of abandoning the Taliban results in, you know, from 1996 to 2001. So, you know, the alternative is what the US sought initially. You know, they engaged in the peace talks, so-called peace talks, with Taliban representatives in Doha. And it should also be noted that, you know, these peace talks took place without the presence of what was at the time the internationally recognized the government of Afghanistan. And so if the plan all along was that, you know, the Taliban would come back into power in Afghanistan, then why all of a sudden have, you know, these extra stipulations on this government? And, you know, because the Taliban will continue to survive for another 20 years the same way that they survived for the past 20 years, but it's the people that will continue to suffer, and, you know, freezing of assets, you know, inflicting sanctions will result in the same kind of consequences for the people of Afghanistan that have resulted for the people in Iran. And you know, if you continue with this policy, what the UN has predicted itself, that, you know, Afghan people are at a very serious and increasing risk every single day of, you know, facing famines, facing shortness of supplies of food, you know, because there's no access, there's no trade that is taking place within this country. So, you know, the consequences of abandonment we've seen, but also the fact that at the moment they have sanctions and they have frozen assets of the people of Afghanistan, this is absolutely detrimental to the well-being of Afghan people.
And last but not least, Mr. Rafiq, do you think regional countries, especially Russia, China, Iran, and Pakistan, should work closely with the Taliban to ensure the group upholds its commitments and demonstrates real political inclusion?
Yes, absolutely. And I think as well, including other neighboring countries like Tajikistan and other regional superpowers like India, must also be considered, because, you know, all these countries have a vested interest in a stabilized, in a secure, and in a peaceful Afghanistan, especially given Afghanistan's geopolitical location, being situated almost, you know, within the center of Eurasia. So any laws and any governments in Afghanistan, especially the Taliban government, must be held account to international law. So any kind of talks that do take place on a regional level must be supervised by the United Nations. And any laws that the Taliban wishes to implement must then be held to, you know, universal standards, because, you know, people of Afghanistan do need security, they do need peace, but they also need those laws and policies to be implemented respectfully in a non-discriminatory fashion and with basic human rights standards.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Iraj Rafiq for his precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media on Taliban's caretaker government dominated by the group's old guard, which lacks inclusivity and popular support.
Kenneth Roth, Human Rights Watch director, says Pakistani Premier Imran Khan suggests Taliban will have an inclusive government if international humanitarian and development assistance is guaranteed to it. Taliban spokesperson Sohail Shaheen reaffirms the group's commitment to have good ties with the international community and even expresses readiness to resolve issues through talks. Asif Durrani, a former Pakistani diplomat, takes a swipe at the US, saying they are calling for an inclusive government from the group that was once rejected by then US Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. Afghan journalist and analyst Hizbullah Khan says Afghanistan is the only country with no recognized government, no economy, no military, and with institutions in shambles. Michael Kugelman, a senior associate at the Wilson Center, points to concerns raised by many regional countries regarding Taliban's caretaker government, saying no one wants to be the first to recognize it.
And that was our episode on the importance of an inclusive and broad-based government in Afghanistan and why the Taliban must heed the calls to take along other political and ethnic groups as well as women. We shall meet again, same time, same day, next week. So till then, take care.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The frightening point is that all the evidence suggests that the US was able to manipulate the legal processes in both Sweden and the UK to engineer Assange effective incarceration all that time until this day, says Jonathan Cook, writer, in an article titled CIA plan to poison Assange wasn't needed. US found lawful way to disappear him. Stay tuned for the second part of this article, please. In the UK, The Guardian has been growing ever closer to the intelligence services since it broke with Assange and Glenn Greenwald, the reporter who brought it the Edward Snowden revelations that the US National Security State was conducting illegal mass surveillance of the public. So, how is it that these newspapers, with their wide-ranging sources inside the intelligence community and their historic investment in the Assange case, heard not a peep about this story over the past 4 years? Is it possible that not one of the 30 or so officials who spoke to Yahoo has also spoken to these newspapers? Why is Yahoo News the one breaking such an important story? And maybe even more to the point, how is it that the three newspapers have all but ignored Yahoo's investigation and so far appear to be doing nothing to follow it up? The Guardian could barely stifle a yawn as it covered the story as an extended brief online and offered a slightly fuller report for its Australian readers, but at least it mentioned the story. Is the fact that large numbers of senior US officials are admitting that their agency seriously thought about abducting or murdering a journalist these publications work with on some of the biggest stories of the modern age not hugely newsworthy for them? But all of this indifference or aversion to reporting on Assange's horrifying plight is par for the course for these respected, supposedly liberal media outlets. Like the rest of the corporate media, they have largely ignored the extradition proceedings going on in the UK courts over the past year and which are due to reach their climax next month when a final hearing is expected. The media's continuing silence can only be understood as complicity in the persecution of a fellow journalist. The Guardian's failings have been particularly egregious. As we have documented before, the paper has barely concealed its vendetta against Assange, much of it falling out with him after one of his senior reporters recklessly exposed a WikiLeaks password to a cache of classified documents that has been exploited by Washington in building its so-called espionage case against Assange. The Guardian has a vested interest. One, it has not disclosed in keeping the spotlight on Assange, rather allowing it to shift to its own role. That is the context for interpreting its pitifully false and malicious story, again provided by intelligence services, tying Assange to a supposed conspiracy between Trump and other partners that has been obsessively advanced by the liberal media. The Guardian's report that the Trump aide, Paul Manafort, and unidentified spies repeatedly visited Assange at the embassy, one of the most heavily surveilled spots in the world, without leaving a single trace of the presence, should never have made it into print. The simplest checks would have raised dozens of red flags, but the paper has chosen silence rather than correcting or withdrawing the story. The only conclusion one can draw from their behavior is that the liberal media, far from being watchdogs on power, regard themselves as agents of power. They feel much closer to the country's secret, duplicity dealing, murderous intelligence services than they do to a fellow journalist being bounded into permanent incarceration. The Yahoo report makes clear too that the surveillance operation against Assange and WikiLeaks intensified dramatically after Snowden released his confidential documents in 2013 in collaboration with reporter Glenn Greenwald. The Snowden files showed that the U.S. had begun expanding its ambition to use new digital technology to covertly surveil the rest of the world. Now, it was increasingly turning that technological prowess inwards to covertly surveil its own population. A transparency organization like WikiLeaks, it quickly became obvious, was a major threat to the U.S. intelligence services' plans. According to Yahoo sources, it was the Obama administration that began surveilling WikiLeaks more intensively and threw the net wider to expose its networks. The CIA was already centrally involved, creating a special WikiLeaks team that worked closely with other friendly spy agencies, including, one can presume, the Five Eyes intelligence-sharing states that also comprise Canada, the UK, Australia, and New Zealand. The goal, Yahoo was told by Evanina, its main named source, was to tie WikiLeaks back to hostile state intelligence services. In other words, the aim was to suggest not that Assange was interested in transparency or acting out of principle, but that he wanted to undermine the U.S. on behalf of a hostile foreign power. Assange's fate was sealed within the Obama administration in summer 2016 when WikiLeaks released a cache of Democratic Party emails that cast Obama's chosen successor Hillary Clinton in a damning light and showed that the party had rigged its election procedures to stop her main challenger, Bernie Sanders, from winning. As an aide, the Yahoo report notes that the idea of kidnapping Assange in violation of Ecuador and the UK sovereignty actually preceded Pompeo's arrival at the CIA. Despite Yahoo's focus on Pompeo, it was actually Obama and the Democratic Party's thirst for vengeance that paved the way for Trump's appointee to have viable options of either prosecuting Assange for espionage or abducting him. Obama's officials immediately tarred Assange as conspiring with Donald Trump, Clinton's rival for the presidential election. He was thereby dragged into an establishment conspiracy theory, Russiagate, that claimed Trump was serving as a puppet of the Kremlin. Given the many years spent under both Obama and Trump trying to shore up this claim by the most digitally advanced states in the world, it comes as something of a surprise to learn that they came up with nothing. The entire case against Assange has been shown to be a house card. Interestingly, Yahoo News report shows that despite the void of evidence, Justice Department officials were keen to concoct a legal case to forestall two dangers that might undermine their efforts to keep Assange incarcerated and preclude them from launching a credible prosecution. The first was the CIA's unhinged scenarios that included a rendition or a possible Hollywood-style gun battle on the streets of London to prevent Ecuador helping Assange escape the embassy. For the CIA to be successful, U.S. Justice Department officials fretted Assange might arrive in the U.S. without any formal or plausible charges leveled against him. The other was that the U.K. was rapidly running out of pretexts to keep Assange locked out of view, after police had been allowed to drag him from the embassy in early 2019. Sweden had already dropped its investigation of Assange in May 2017, so Assange was moved to Belmarsh Maximum Security Prison on charges relating to a minor bail infraction. Those charges ignored the fact that he had violated his bail conditions only because he was seeking political asylum as recognized in international law. The UK judge issued the maximum sentence possible for such an infraction, giving the US time to formulate the espionage case that has provided the pretext for keeping him locked up ever since, in conditions during a pandemic that have put his life at risk. The truth is that, appalling as the Yahoo News revelations are, they fail to convey the reality that the United States could count on multiple states, not least the UK, to conspire in providing a legal veneer to a decades-long covert war against Assange and WikiLeaks for exposing US war crimes. Even more frightening, all the evidence suggests that the United States was also able to manipulate the legal processes in both Sweden and the UK to engineer Assange's effective incarceration all that time and to this day. And even more terrifying, the same evidence suggests that the establishment media in several countries could be relied on at best to turn a blind eye to a fellow journalist's prosecution and at worst to actively conspire in that persecution. Yahoo News provided a great service in bringing some of the reality about Assange's persecution to light. But there is much more to unearth. Sadly, our supposed watchdogs on power appear far too busy feeding at the trot to start sniffing out more of the truth. Economic divide.
It is a known fact that Israel has influence in many industries in the world, in particular when it comes to the financial world. But to what extent does it have influence in that industry? Hi, I'm Kavit Ahli. This edition of Economic Divide, we will look at Israeli control in financial sectors like payment systems, and in particular, its penetration in the U.S. financial system. Coming up in today's program, Israeli influence over the United States. Does it overlap into U.S.'s financial system, like the Fed or Wall Street? We'll take a close look at Fortune 500 companies like J.P. Morgan Chase. How did it and others like it become the largest banks in the U.S.? Then we're going to take a look at a recent deal that occurred between PayPal and the ADL. Partnership to fight extremism and hate through the financial industry, but does PayPal have ulterior motives, like going after Israeli critics? And then finally, we'll take a look at two technologies that are present in the financial system, namely fintech and blockchain. Why are there so many startups and investments in Israel in this technology? And why the concentration on payment systems? Recently, there was a team up of two entities that made news, and that relates to how Israeli companies are taking control or influencing, at a minimum, financial tools, in this case, payment system. PayPal Holdings Incorporated, in partnership with ADL, stands for the Anti-Defamation League, announced a new partnership initiative to fight extremism and hate through the financial industry. Now, Israel's control of these types of payment systems, especially in the digital money area, has led to it to target whom it sees as its adversaries, whether in business or politics, like Hamas or Iran.
The Anti-Defamation League is announcing a new partnership with PayPal to defund hate groups.
The dollar-swapping firm PayPal announced a new initiative to track and disrupt payment activity from extremist and hate groups. They would be aided in this effort, they said, by the Anti-Defamation League and a coalition of partner organizations.
From the sounds of it, it appears to be a good initiative, right? But think again. PayPal partnering with ADL to fight extremism and to protect marginalized communities is not all that it appears to be. To combat criminal activity or zoom in on transactions that fund human trafficking or illicit smuggling, like drug smuggling, are all good initiatives. Problem is when the issue takes a political turn. ADL is zooming in on extremists or hate groups, and herein lies the problem. To begin with, hate groups are not illegal. Furthermore, what is the definition that the ADL uses to define this? Well, it doesn't take much investigation to figure this out. ADL, which stands for the Anti-Defamation League, is a leading anti-hate organization that was founded in 1913 in response to an escalating climate of anti-Semitism and bigotry.
ADL, as we've talked about on your show before, is the oldest anti-hate group in the country. And we've been focused on studying extremist individuals, organizations, and movements literally for decades. And our experts in our Center on Extremism are some of the best analysts in the U.S. and understanding groups across the ideological spectrum.
To that end, it serves another entity, Israel. The ADL, therefore, can go after hate groups that don't endorse or agree with Israeli policies, like the Hamas resistance groups or Hezbollah. It can even go further and target countries, like the Islamic Republic of Iran, or other countries that condemn Israeli violation of Palestinians. ADL may even go as far as proposing PayPal to shut down social media accounts of users who engage in what ADL defines as hate and extremism.
Well, joining us now to discuss this further is Rodney Martin. He's a political activist, a current affairs analyst. He's also a historian and researcher. Martin is the chairman of the American Nationalist Association. He also hosts a regular radio podcast by the name of World View Conversations. Rodney is also a former U.S. congressional staffer and political candidate, as well as having served in local and state government. Rodney, welcome. Recently, there's this partnership that was announced between PayPal Holdings Incorporated and ADL, the Anti-Defamation League. This partnership initiative to have as its goal fighting extremism and hate through the financial industry. What are your thoughts on this in terms of the way that this partnership has been announced and the goal that it has in front of it?
Well, absolutely, and that's been taking, it first started taking place on the social media platforms, particularly Facebook. And then it spread now into the PayPal, who won't allow PayPal transactions if they disagree with a person's political views. And it's interesting, they have a very subjective view of extremism. You do not see PayPal, Facebook, and social media, these giants, censoring Israeli and Jewish extremism, particularly those that praise the murder of Palestinian and Arab women and children, that advocate pro-war policies and seek to essentially manipulate the American political system, society, and culture, that the manipulation of financial markets and the media has become very easy, as well as censorship, because you now have people who on one hand will decry censorship if they say something versus, say, a Republican versus the Democratic Party. But if somebody says something critical of Israel, those same people that are calling for censorship wants those people censored. So it's really a schizophrenic system that has developed in the United States as a result of outside influences by a very, very small minority. Powerful, but powerful.
Okay, well, let's get the thoughts of Alison Weir and introduce her. Alison Weir is the director, or the executive director, of Americans New, a nonprofit organization that focuses on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and also the foreign policy of the United States regarding West Asia. Alison, welcome. What are your thoughts on this PayPal and ADL partnership? In some sense, doesn't this pave the way for them to go after what, for example, ADL sees that is suiting its purpose of what constitutes extremism, hate, or whatever it deems to be anti-Israeli, which includes what's posted on social media outlets like Facebook?
I think there's no doubt that this type of thing is used by Israel all the time to target people it dislikes and to take down websites it doesn't want that contains information they dislike. I think that's very clear. The Anti-Defamation League, I feel, is one of the real problems in the United States, because this has a very benign reputation. I used to think of it as a good organization, because most of us are against defamation, against bigotry, against any kind of unfair racial profiling or prejudice. But it turns out that the Anti-Defamation League is really very largely focused on advocating for Israel, these exaggerated views of Jewish culpability, because all Jewish Americans are not guilty of that. We're talking about individuals.
It's time now for our InfoNews section, where we pick topics old and new that we find important or don't get enough media attention or exposure. Now, what is going on with energy resources? China, this is a topic that we thought was important, has actually ordered energy firms to secure winter fuel supplies, and this is the part that's interesting, at all costs. That means to do whatever it takes to secure fuel supplies. Now, that's going to put further pressure on the price of gas that's paid already by struggling UK energy suppliers, as an example, which is already grappling with power cuts. Now, let's follow this up with that UK energy crisis, which is on the cusp of that, if it's not already, of mammoth proportions. People there may experience an 80% increase in their gas bills. And it's happened already. Energy firm Bulb under fire for monthly bill rises of up to 80%. Now, keep in mind that the UK is already plagued by fuel poverty that leads to thousands of deaths during the harsh, cold winter season. Next up, climate crisis. Apple and Disney, if you can believe it, are among companies that are backing groups against the U.S. climate bill. That's right. Amazon and Microsoft are supporting groups fighting legislation to fight climate change. This is despite promises to combat the climate crisis. And of course, as you can see there, that's the budget allocated for that $3.35 trillion. Finally, the chip crisis is not going away, and in particular this for car chips. And what's happened is that it's such a serious problem that car manufacturing in Britain actually fell by 27%. And then Mercedes-Benz also is experiencing problems, warning against possible delay in delivering new cars by at least 1 year.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English.